you begin talking about
the principles according to which you organize your life, then you're doing ethics. And I want to suggest that even when we don't reflect upon it too deeply, we operate with certain presuppositions that make possible a very, very dangerous and inhumane kind of ethics. It matters very much when you're doing ethics what kind of a conception of man you have, what you think man is. And I believe that the kind of society that we have long cherished in this country, I call it a liberal democratic society. That doesn't mean if you're a member of the ADA, there are Republicans and Democrats who are liberal Democrats with a small L and a small D. I do not believe that a liberal democratic society is compatible with every conception of man, and that if we are increasingly accepting a notion of humanity like the one I'm describing, then I think our liberal democratic society is doomed. I hope not. I'm trying to keep it from happening by quarreling with the presuppositions of our time. I think you can summarize the current situation today in popular ethics and political thought. I'm going to talk about political thought on Saturday. By saying that we are relativists in principle and absolutists in practice. Now, that's a very odd combination. What does it mean, and how did we come to be in such a pickle? One of the most important influences, I think, has been philosophy, academic thinking. Now, philosophers, I agree, most people don't read philosophers and they don't pay any attention to what they say while they're living. But philosophical arguments begin filtering down into a culture. They pass through, the social scientists, who are less abstract. And then they get down into the magazines. And pretty soon everybody's taking them for granted. All the best minds of our time say. And usually what this means is all the best minds of our time said 50 years ago. But there are several streams of thought that have fed into our culture, our contemporary life, that have caused this interesting juxtaposition of contraries, that we are relativists in principle, kind of absolute relativists, that means, so that in practice we are dogmatic absolutists. One of them is moral philosophy, running from David Hume, the father of many things, through such contemporary people as A.J. Ayer, the late G.E. Moore, Charles Stevenson, names that probably aren't familiar to you, but who have influenced you, though you don't know it. It was Hume who first insisted that there's a logical gulf between statements containing the word is and statements that contain the word ought. And Hume said, no matter how long a list of statements you come up with that contain the word is, you will never be able to deduce from them one single statement containing the word ought. Now, what does that imply? Statements containing the word is describe reality, what's out there, the world the way she really is, including us, the way we really are. But if you can't deduce statements containing the word ought, ethical statements, judgments about what should be done, from statements containing the word is, then reality has nothing to do with ethics. And if reality has nothing to do with ethics, what does our ethics have to do with? Where do our ethical judgments come from? What are they based upon? In any event, whatever they're based on, they don't seem to be based on anything demonstrable. You certainly cannot deduce ethics from science. That's what all the philosophers after Hume concluded. You can't get ethics out of science. Because science confines itself to describing what is. So what ethics does, I guess, is express our preferences. The science tells us what is, and ethics comes along and adds wishes or preferences or recommendations or however you choose to put it. But in any event, you can't verify ethical statements. You can't prove an ethical statement true or false because there's no set of facts against which you can put it. You know, like I say, it is wrong to steal. Now, what set of facts could I put that against? Can I go out and say, see, nobody steals? Well, even if that were true, if it isn't true, I wouldn't prove that it's wrong to steal. But, you hunt around for the facts by which you can prove an ethical statement, and they don't exist. So we conclude facts have nothing to do. Now, I'm not saying philosophers are saying this. I'm beginning to talk about the fallout from philosophy. As the way it came to be put much later is, the good is not a natural attribute. You don't find goodness in nature the way you do find, supposedly, things like heaviness or solubility or saltiness. These are things in nature. But if the good is not in nature, then what is it? Where is it? What do we mean when we say, this is good, or this is right, or this is what we ought to do? Well, now, philosophers in this century have played interminably with this question. What do we mean when we make these statements? And today, they are far less sure, and certainly far less united, on what we mean than they used to be, than they were just a generation ago. But there was, as I say, a kind of a popular fallout in this whole discussion. The popular fallout runs something like this. And if you want to find the fallout, one good place to turn is to the introductory chapter in the books on social science, from history through economics to psychology, the introductory chapter that deals with what we're going to study in this course. And you will see certain philosophical dogmas laid down. And these dogmas, I call the popular fallout from this discussion. And you see, these dogmas have an influence because the kids read these textbooks and they assume, golly, it's in the textbook. In fact, it's in all the textbooks in much the same sort of way. And these are things that cannot be questioned. And these become the absolute presuppositions of our time. And what do these textbooks say? What have we all been taught? We've been taught that ethical statements are value judgments. Now, what's a value judgment? Fundamentally, a value judgment is a statement of your personal preference. Now, sure, it's more earnest, maybe, more momentous, more important than the statement, I like spinach. But basically, it's like it. Logically, it's just like it. Suppose I say, I like spinach. And you say, that's wrong. That's not true. I do not like spinach. it's a silly argument. But now, see, I say it is wrong to steal. Somebody says, what you mean is, you don't like stealing. And I say, well, yeah, that's what I mean. The other guy says, I do like stealing. Well, where's the argument? See, there's no argument here. No possibility of argument. Even if all men agree that it is good to tell the truth, this would still be only a value judgment. And the only is crucial. That only means that the judgment has no basis in what is. It's not a statement about how things are out there. It's just a statement about how men feel about them. In the economics books, textbooks, introductory books that I use, the way it is frequently put, it so frightens me, that the book will say, now, economics is going to help you to see how things hang together. How one thing follows another. We study what is, we study reality. But will this help you to make policy judgments? No. Because you can't make policy judgments until you know what you want, what the good is. And now here everybody has to rely on his own personal tastes. We get the kids right to the point where they may be equipped to talk about the good society, if I can use that phrase. And then you tell them, now, kiddies, on the really important questions of society and life, everybody's got his own opinion, and let's just pull them all together, stir carefully. That's the impression they get. Because what it comes down to is that when we discuss ethics, all we're discussing is subjective preferences, very little more. Yeah.
To me, there's a difference between liking spinach and not liking stealing, because it's been found that when stealing is suppressed, that things work out better that way. Whereas whether or not somebody's finished doesn't seem to have near that impact upon how well things work out.
Yeah, but the person will just push the argument and say, well, that's true. Sure, you can show there's certain consequences from stealing, but when you've shown those consequences, then you have to question, but are those consequences good or bad? And that finally comes down to a matter of how you feel about things. See, stealing is bad because it destroys private property. Somebody else says, but private property is theft. And then we say, well, you bet your value judgment, I got mine.
Well, no, stealing results in breakdown of production, probably. If everyone's out trying to steal what everybody else has got, nobody's producing anything. Well, so everybody starves to death, and to me, that's not just a value judgment.
Look, the thing is, I agree with you, so I can't really argue with you. But still, the position that I'm describing, I'm convinced, is finally inadequate, though I will argue it contains a grain of truth. There's a salutary lesson in it, but it isn't enough. We've got to assert some of the things that that were being asserted here by the philosophers and add something else that you're beginning to move toward.
Okay. Go ahead. Okay.
C.S. Lewis, in his delightful little book, The Abolition of Man, talks about this in the first chapter. He shows how this feeds down into our culture. He picks up a textbook on English, and it shows how these guys are brainwashing the students. They begin right away by saying, now, we have to be very careful about how we use language. When somebody says, this is sublime, he doesn't really mean that is sublime. What he means is, I have sublime feelings. And then Lewis goes on to construct an argument very similar to the one that I'm making here. So he gets into other things too. That's a delightful little book that you might try looking at sometime. But the other stream of academic thought I think is very important comes from the social sciences. And once again, it originated in a desire for the purity of scientific statements. You see, early social scientists, like, let me take Adam Smith, who was my spiritual father. Adam Smith was notoriously lax about distinguishing his scientific statements from his policy judgments. And when Adam Smith, for example, talks about the system of natural liberty, is he describing the way things are, the way they run? Or is he describing the way things ought to be, the way he would like to see them organized? And sometimes I think he's talking about one, and sometimes he's talking about the other. The famous phrase, the invisible hand, for example, which occurs only once in the Wealth of Nations, but the passage is often quoted. Now, what did Smith mean? He said, there is an invisible hand which so orders things that when everybody pursues his own interest, he is led, miraculously sort of, to pursue the social good. Was Smith saying this invisible hand is God, God's ordination of things, so that if you don't accept this system, you are running counter to the law of God, it is your duty to bow down to this system? Or is Smith just saying, well, as a matter of fact, most of the time this is how it works out, and it's so complicated and difficult to describe and almost miraculous that I call it an invisible hand. Now you see, the second statement would be a kind of description. The first statement would be very ethical policy, a policy judgment. Well, after social scientists decided they had to be scientific, they concluded they got to get all of these policy judgments, all these ethical statements out of their social science. And so we all set out to create a value-free social science. Because social scientists were very, very concerned to have authority. They still are. They want to be experts. They want people to listen when they talk. Now, who's going to listen to a social scientist if he thinks that the social scientist is just prejudiced? And what he's really doing, you know, is spelling out these prejudices. Social scientists want people to come to them and say, give us the truth. Tell us how things really are. And if we are ever going to enjoy the same respect that the physicists enjoy, then we're going to have to get all of our ethics out of our social science. You see what we say? When a chemist looks at hydrogen combining with oxygen, he doesn't adopt a moral attitude. But when a sociologist looks at a woman combining with a man, he gets his ethics all involved there. So we have to learn to view human affairs with the same attitude of detachment and objectivity that a chemist has when he looks in his test tube. Just in passing, I'm not sure that the chemist is so detached. I believe that there is an erotic element in chemistry and physics. It's not bad, it's necessary. I think the physical scientist does. Well, I think Larry Collins, I think, has a little love affair going with rocks. there is an erotic element in knowledge, an attachment, a passion for it, which is a very great and good thing, but that confuses the issue. The social scientists have an image of the physical scientist as a detached, objective, impartial spectator who described the world exactly as it goes and couldn't give a damn. And that's what he wants to be. He'll get all that authority and prestige. He'll build a true science. The trouble is, of course, that people are not rocks. but they can't be viewed as if they were rocks. I mean, complicated rocks, of course. B.F. Skinner says, we will ultimately find, and this is an article I'm quoting, we will ultimately find, he's a psychologist, we will ultimately find, and this is one of the preconditions of any scientific activity, that human behavior is simply a somewhat more complicated version of the behavior of rats. At least rats are more complicated than rocks. Although you look at some of Leo's pictures and you see what scientists are today finding out about rats, and somebody says, merely as complicated as a rat, golly. Rats are tremendously complicated.
Even cells of lungs are
That's what I was thinking. That made a tremendous impact. If you see those lymphocytes. The mystery, how anybody can say simply anything. I don't know. I'm just a mystic. I'm sorry. But here's what science, this is what social science looks like. Hard as it may be to keep our value judgments from intruding on our social science, we must make the effort if the social sciences are ever to take their place in the ranks of genuine science. Now, there are enormous difficulties standing in the way of this program, and I'm not going to refer to those, because the point, in any event, is not that the social scientists succeeded or didn't succeed in getting their value judgments out of their social science. The point is that they made it a program. And today, loyalty to the program constitutes one of your first credentials if you want to be accepted as a social scientist. If you do not raise your right hand and swear loyalty to this program, you are called a social evangelist, or some other term that clearly dismisses you from the ranks of the scientist. So what it comes down to is that officially, therefore, in social science, as Bentham so well put it, pushpin is as good as poetry. Pushpin was a silly game people used to play in the day. Let's say they did it. The Beatles are as good as mine. I was picking the Beatles. Some people say the Beatles are good. In political science, for example, you study democracy and oligarchy and monarchy, and you say they're just different forms of government. You study primogeniture, and you study matrilocal residence, and you study headhunting. And you say these are just different cultural institutions. Patterns of culture vary enormously, but they are just different. Scientifically, nothing can be said to be better than anything else. And remember, science rules what is. So if you can't say, for example, that if science cannot tell you whether headhunting is good or bad, that means there is nothing in reality that tells you whether headhunting is good or bad. That's the way it kind of works out. But, of course, we do make such valuations. We do not approve of headhunting. Even if we can't say scientifically headhunting is bad, we don't like it. We are not indifferent between democracy and oligarchy. What are these valuations? So it's all right, so they're not scientific. I say I like democracy, and that's not scientific. Is it a valid judgment? Is democracy good? If we can't scientifically decide whether one set of cultural institutions is superior to another, how can we decide? What's the sense, finally, in a statement like, a liberal democratic society is worth defending? What's the sense in that statement? Why is it worth defending, if it is? Is it just because I like it? Is it because I've been conditioned to like it, maybe? The Nazis did not like it. They preferred a different set of social arrangements. What do we say? To each his own? Is that all we can say? Some people like living with Jews, some people don't. People are different. Is that all we can validly say? Well, as you point out, we can point out scientifically the consequences of different things, of course, and we do that. And that helps us to make value judgments. But what I find in the social sciences today and in popular thinking is this conviction that when you get down to the real nitty-gritty, to the place where the water hits the wheel, then it's a matter of value judgments. And value judgments mean my personal preference, my feelings inside, which depend, of course, on how I've been conditioned. I think it's still the most influential book in anthropology ever written is Ruth Benedict's Patterns of Culture, published in the 1930s. And its data about the Zuni and the Kwakiutl and the Dobu are pretty dated now. Anthropologists don't accept much of her data. But her data weren't what were so influential anyway. What was influential was her proclamation, her presupposition. And that book was a very forceful argument for cultural relativism. What she was trying to show in that book is that there was no standpoint outside of a culture from which you could judge it. Every culture functioned, you see. Every culture was unique. It operated in accordance with some kind of inner necessity. It was coherent, and it served to integrate the people of that culture. And she warned that for too long we've been running around using the standards of Western culture to evaluate other cultures, and we said they were inferior because they didn't meet our tests of excellence and virtue. Now, I want to stress here, there is in all of this a very, very salutary lesson. Cultural provincialism and chauvinism have darkened Western history. We have been insolent. We've been much too quick to speak of inferior peoples and barbarian cultures. The missionaries have supposed that the sixth commandment was given by God, therefore it was universal, and what the sixth commandment requires in England is that women wear shirts, so it requires it also in Tahiti. This is, I think, a good example of this kind of cultural provincialism, or missionaries going into Nigeria and forcing men to divorce some of their wives if they want to become Christians in the name of God's law, with no sense, no recollection that it somehow wasn't quite God's law in the Old Testament. But we have been insolent in passing judgment on other cultures. But the trouble is, I think, we move between extremes. The fact that we have in the past judged insolently and wrongly what is good for people in other cultures does not force us to conclude that each culture is sovereign in its own domain. It does not force us to conclude that what Hitler did to the Jews cannot be called wrong because most of the Germans approved of it. And if they did, we don't really believe that. Incidentally, Ruth Benedict didn't really believe it either, because her book is full of implicit criticisms of her own culture. And that's the most valuable part of the book. If you do not believe that there is any standpoint from which man can judge culture, then you say man is merely a cog in the social machine. He is conditioned by the social machinery, and he has no choice but to play his role. Then you say that society is superior to man. And that's the conclusion to which absolute cultural relativism finally pushes you.
You know, that particular book of Ruth Benedict's, too, is one that belongs in every lay library because of its helpfulness, I think, in self-discovery. I mean, many, many people have never gotten hold of these handles, the Dionysian, the Apollonian, you know, this kind of relationship which helps you to understand yourself and your children is different from you, and the war of the generation, the youth, Dionysian, and the age of the Apollonian, and it really is a helpful handle. I just want to put in this footnote here because it's one of those books which reads well and which belongs, I think, in every intelligent person's vocabulary term. Don't you? That's part of it.
Although I did find I reread that book 2 years ago. I read it a long time ago. I reread it and I wasn't quite as gripped. I remember the first time I read it, I just went,
well, these terms were books. Then.
Well, I don't know. I think books do get a little dated. It's a book that has formed our generation.
Well, you kind of assimilate its presuppositions, then when you read it again, that, you know, it sounds obvious. I think that's one maybe, thing that happens to
maybe that's, yeah. You know. It ain't so shocking.
But I still think it's helpful with the war of the generations, not least, because it gives you a little bit more patience with your kids. You don't expect them to act like 70 when they're 17. They're in the Dionysian period.
I said that cultural, this kind of absolute cultural relativism pushes us to a very uncomfortable position, and I don't want you to suppose that absolute relativism is a combination too ridiculous to be believed and acted on. Because when cultural relativism becomes an unquestioned and unquestionable presupposition, then it is absolute. If this is something that, how can you question that? Then it's absolute. And if relativism cannot be questioned, then it's an absolute relativism.
Could I ask a question about that last conclusion, though, that because it's a little bit unclear to me as to just what you mean when you say that absolute cultural relativism renders us only cogs in the historical machine. Would seem that it would leave open the alternative position that, all right, if you try to judge it from a point outside all systems, no such point exists. Therefore, you'll have to judge from inside the system and say, this is the set of values which I aim to impose upon the nation. And this is quite a different thing from being simply a cog.
Yeah, but that's what I think we need to do. You see, you can't be outside of it and criticize it.
That's right.
But you can be inside it. You can get with it. You can feel it, sense it, be a part of it. But yet to criticize, don't you have to, in some sense, step outside, stand above? Isn't this what critical judgment implies? It implies some power of transcendence.
Doesn't also apply a higher standard, therefore a frame of reference of values by which you can judge these relative systems.
In other words, it would have to.
And so on.
Suppose you just said, no, I'm part of the system. I can't step outside it. I just can't reach that overarching hierarchy. It's been taken away from me. So here I sit. By George, I'll level my judgments from where I am inside the system. I'll say Hitler was wrong. And I'll elaborate my arguments, but I know that ultimately it is my judgment and no one else's. Now, I don't see the transcendence here.
Well,
internally criticized.
Because if you just say it's my judgment and nobody else's, then you get the problem. I want to get into that. What? Why do you criticize? What are you trying to accomplish? It's just your judgment and nobody else's. If you just believe this is the way you feel, you might say, I don't like his mustache. Or, I don't like the way he feels about Jews.
Yeah.
What gives you the courage, the determination to get in there and try to change that?
The thing that gives you the courage is that this is your personal conviction as to how you'd like to see the universe ordered.
You're a tyrant at heart.
Absolutely. Absolute tyrant. You can't scare me with
I don't want to scare you with that. I don't really want to apply after this, but I'm afraid that what happens when somebody says, this is my feeling, and I'm going to get in there and fight for it, he does become a tyrant.
Because
I want to argue that there's an alternative. There's something in between here. And it comes down to moral discourse. And it involves some presuppositions that you do not have to accept, but which I think are the presuppositions of common sense and of perennial philosophy and of science. And they're ones to which we had better return before we drift into a world of that vacillates between privatism and apathy and violent conflict as the only alternative. So I love everything you're saying, because this pole of the individual, committed, dedicated, determined, operating out of something needs to be asserted. I so deeply believe that there is learning in this, a transcendent element that you employ to criticize. Because, by golly, you don't go out and risk your life to stop the Hitler regime just because you don't feel nicely about it. You can say, well, I'll entertain my feelings and I'll just retreat, or I'll get out of the country.
I refuse to sneer at personal feelings. I think this is the essence of conviction.
Yeah.
The rest is window dressing.
I'm not sneering at it, but there are more.
No, you are, though. You know,
I don't mean to. I do not mean to. I do not mean to.
Simply because you feel. You know, this is the sneer that people apply to personal feelings. And I think I could venture a prediction that the common sense, the preconceptions, the presuppositions that you are about to elaborate will turn out to be your feelings.
They will have my feelings as one element, but there is something else that I firmly believe the individual operates with. He does not say just that. You see, you don't say, when you go out to attack Hitler, when you risk your life, you do not say, I'm risking my life simply because I don't, that this is contrary to my personal preferences. You say this is demonic.
Yes.
Or wrong.
Yes.
And you are suggesting that there is something.
But the analysis is, upon what grounds do you base this demoniacal application?
Okay.
And you finally come down to say, well, to me, it's demoniacal.
And there's where we disagree. I don't think you finally come down. And I argue that if that is where you finally come down, then we're in trouble.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Okay, I want to suggest that there's a way out. That there's a way out that preserves this individuality, private feeling, intensity of concern with an objective element. And I want to suggest a way to get them together.
Those of you who will be here when Ricky comes will discover how well this two work together from their opposite points of view here. Develop the same argument.
Goodbye, I like to be
a quip I heard years ago, I think fits right now. Any stigma will do to be the dominant.
That's true. That's true. And I want you to be aware of that. I said Tuesday. I ain't got no Mount Nebo up here, and I sometimes toss off flippant statements for dramatic impact, which can be stigmas. And you've got to examine my terms to be sure that I'm not dismissing by labeling. I had a professor at the seminary who had a way of getting rid of every theologian of whom he didn't approve, and I don't think he approved of anyone except Francis Pieper. By labeling it, some of us say, well, gee, what do you think of this notion? Is it Calvinistic? you don't have to deal with it. Oh, no. It goes in the Calvinistic box, so we study that when we study comparative religions. let me try to spell out this alternative, and then we talk. You see, what I find in my classes, and I teach some classes where I teach you one in comparative economic systems, and you're getting into questions of good and evil, and if you don't, raise these questions, you're not teaching anything. And I sometimes get the students make judgments, say, ooh, how can you be in favor of that? How can you accept that? I don't care if it does work, it's bad. And I say, well, why is it bad? And they say, well, because it's contrary to free enterprise. And I say, well, is free enterprise good? And they'll say, here it goes, well, I think it's good. I say, but are you right? Well, I think so. But why do you think so? Well, because that's the way I was brought up, that's the way I was reared, that's the way I was conditioned. I said, but were you conditioned correctly? Do you want to condition your kids that way? And they look at me and say, well, I haven't got any choice. I mean, that's why I was conditioned. That's what I believe. And I said, well, now look, I'm not asking for the cause of why you feel this way about free enterprise. I want to know your reasons, not cause of reason. And they look at me blankly. They deny any power of transcending the culture and criticize me. And it isn't found just among, say, ethical relativists. It's found among biblical fundamentalists. You get the same thing. We'll talk about it a couple years ago in class. We were, and I was teaching a course called The Nature of Man, where you get into anything. And I raised, because I thought these kids were operating with some cultural real provincialism, and yet they were vacillating between cultural insolence and absolute relativism. I raised the question of homosexuality, and this really disturbed them, because they didn't know what did they knew they had attitudes to homosexuals of which they didn't approve, and at the same time there was something really wrong with homosexuality, something out of kilter there. But one of the guys, I remember, said, I don't see why we're discussing this. Homosexuality is wrong. I said, why? Because the Bible says so. And I said, well, do you believe the Bible that says so? Well, I've been brought up to believe the Bible. I said, well, but is the Bible right? Well, I don't know, but that's what I was taught. I didn't push him quite that way, but this is where he defended himself. This is what he'd been taught. He didn't know whether it was right or wrong. In fact, he admitted he didn't even know how to interpret the Bible. But he'd been brought up to believe this on the basis of the Bible, and so that was it. So he, too, was a kind of an absolute. There's no point in discussing it, because, see, I was brought up in the Baptist Sunday school. Now, the guy says there's no point in talking about the free enterprise, because I was brought up in a capitalist home.
You should have asked him where it says in the Bible that, and then he'd really been stuck.
Well, he wasn't worried about that.
Oh, he wasn't even
the point was, what he came down to was, look, I've been brought up in a pious, devout home, and I have no choice but to believe that homosexuality is wrong. So all he wasn't telling us that homosexuality was wrong. He was telling us how he believed. And he didn't think there was anything more to talk about. Well, now, if you see the trouble is, this is what I'm afraid. If values are only tastes or products of conditioning, then what happens when our values differ? What happens when they differ, and they differ on an important issue? What happens when we can't both have our way? You like socialism and I like capitalism. Take an extreme example. What happens when we disagree? And it's important. If values are just tastes, and there's no disputing tastes, all we can do is fight. We put it to the test of power. Now, this is not tolerance. And if you don't care, say, well, you go your way, I'll go mine. That's not a virtue either. That's not tolerance. It isn't tolerance to let somebody go his own way when you don't care. And yet this is the strange situation that confronts us today, that we call ourselves tolerant. We call ourselves tolerant when, in fact, I think, we vacillate between the extremes of not giving a rip and insisting, when it comes down to issues, upon having our own way. The alternative now, and I'd like to hear this out before you blast it. The alternative is to begin by maintaining that value judgments are judgments about reality. That ethical statements are finally statements about the nature of man in the world. Therefore, they can be intelligently discussed, compared, evaluated, modified, corrected. This activity, which has been called moral discourse, is a cooperative attempt by man to discover that profound and ambiguous reality to which our ethical judgments try to give expression. There is something up there, but we can't detect it. We get only a glimpse of it. And therefore, we must seriously engage our neighbor in moral discourse so that our partial view can be modified, deepened, corrected, enriched, and so that we can do the same for him. And this, I think, you could call absolutism in principle. For it begins in the presupposition that what is good and just judges me. It stands finally above my personal preferences. It remains good and just, even though I should deny it. That's the presupposition. And that's why I call it absolutism in principle. And not so strangely, that kind of absolutism in principle is compatible with, and I think it urges, a very decided relativism in practice. You see, when there is no right and wrong, then we don't dare yield an inch of our prejudices. When if right and wrong are purely created by my preferences, then I've got to be firm and adamant, I've got to be stubborn. It's a well-known foible of human nature that we're most shrill when we have no basis for our opinion. We're most stubborn when we're defending the indefensible. Or in theological language, if God is good, then I am not the last line of defense. And because I am not God, I dare not behave as if I were. Now, there are four things, it seems to me, that are presupposed in this act of moral discourse. It presupposes moral earnestness. Because, you know, this is a difficult task, to sit down with the man in your society, your culture, with whom you disagree profoundly about an ethical issue or political issue, and talk to him. That requires disciplined effort. And if I didn't really care, I wouldn't bother trying. I was fooling. So a person willing to engage in real moral discourse displays moral earnestness. Secondly, it presupposes self-respect. Because moral discourse is an act of self-disclosure in which you reveal to another what is of ultimate concern to you. And there's risk in this. He may label you. He may call you a red or a reactionary. Or he may ridicule your deepest convictions. He may try to undermine them. And without self-respect, I don't think you would dare. You wouldn't risk it. It presupposes respect for the other person, because you know then that he too is in the grip of some ultimate concern. You take this for granted. No matter how much you disagree with him, you just affirm that he too has a vision of the good and the just. And this is what drives you back continually to talk to him, to try to discern that vision which is floating before his eyes. You insist that he too has a passion for the truth, a vision of reality, a love of the good. If you didn't believe this, you wouldn't engage in discourse. And interestingly, when you cease to believe it of anyone, when you say, oh, he's just talking because he likes to argue, then you withdraw and you stop engaging in moral discourse. And finally, it presupposes moral discourse, a common reality and a common humanity. It denies the ultimate obscurantism, which asserts that there's nothing but an infinite number of prejudices. Moral discourse presupposes the possibility of truth by supposing that we are all human beings living in the same world. And therefore, there is nothing which is not in principle accessible to anyone if it is accessible to any other. Now, who wants to deny these presuppositions? I mean, Harold, can I wind them and roll them up? If you've given the presupposition of a common reality and a common humanity, and that's the presupposition of science, of all art up to the age of anti-art, given respect for others, which is the basis of all morality, given respect for self, which is equally the basis of all morality, given moral earnestness, without which, when we talk of duetics, we're either fraud or puppets, then I think we have no choice but to engage in moral discourse and to choose any other course when significant ethical judgments differ. Choose any other course than to engage one another in earnest discussion, dialogue, turns out to be nihilism. And science gives no support for this. Many people think it does. But science itself, you see, is a rational, humane activity founded on, rooted in these same principles. Science presupposes all this. I recommend for you Bernowski's book, Science and Modern, well, Science and Human Values. We spend too much time looking at the results of science, not enough time looking at science as a humane activity.
But all that author for them, because again, this is a basic book for any lay library.
Bronowski.
And he writes well. He is a
beautiful writer. Science and Human Values. It's a Harper Torch book. Let me make one set out.
It's required book content for most people going to college. They read before they come to college university.
Let me add one sentence now. And you can punch your hands, I'll try to get you in order. If I can speak out of your request, what I say we have to do is assert that my feelings have a transcendent ground, but I don't have a handle on that ground. And therefore I need, I want to let him talk next, and then her and then Jim back there. And Ken. I wasn't arguing with you, I was trying to express it in the terms that you introduced. So. There is ultimately in reality a distinction between good and evil, but we need every other man to discern. Okay, now, I hope that hasn't been too much. Harold, you're first.
Well, I just thought the interesting thing about your talk there is that you really returned to Hume's whole thing in your conclusion. He was willing to admit that in reality there was good and evil. The only problem was that through the senses and through reason he had no access to it. And the only way we knew it was through the passions. And so he says that reason is and ought to be the slave of the passions. And reasonably we sort of relate our passions and put them in, you know, some kind of sensible way to understand them. But it seems to me what you're saying is advocating a kind of pluralistic motivism, and pragmatically we come together as, you know, passionate people that feel strongly one way or another, and who, you know, claim to have through the passions and access to moral reality, and this kind of discourse is a
well. I'm glad I do not come back to Hume's position, at least I do not intend to, because I believe that through reason and the senses we do attain the vision of this reality, and I think that statement, reason must be the slave of the passions, is precisely where I disagree. The passions must become the slave of reason.
What I don't understand is how, in your development, you've got reason to have an access to these things.
Well, you're not raising a psychological question, right?
No, not
psychological.
Just be allowed for it.
What is the reason?
In other words, how does reason know of the good? I mean, how do you answered Hume's basic disjunction between the is and the other.
I think it's an artificial disjunction that Hume postulated to solve a problem.
Yeah, but that, you're sort of answering it in a third force.
No, it is possible to say where Hume, if you begin where Hume begins, you come out where Hume comes out. I don't think that Hume's beginning point is bad. It's not necessary. I guess I'm returning to a prior vision that when you look at when sense impressions come in through the eyes, you get not only redness or whatever else you get, whatever it's supposed to be out there, you also get goodness.
A non-natural quality.
That goodness is a natural quality. Okay. Goodness is, I would submit, I don't want to get into that. I mean, this gets us into pretty philosophical questions. But I would argue that goodness inheres in reality as much as hardness does, and as little as hardness does, because hardness does not inhere in things either.
God saw his creation and it was good. So
that's a good, that would be a good metaphor. God saw his creation and it was good. He didn't cuddle up to it and say, feels good. I don't know, do you think we
want to go through all of Hume's arguments? Yeah. I really don't see how you've got either the senses or reason, you know, in a position where they can apprehend goodness.
Okay. I certainly don't blame you for not seeing it.
Being above, I can hardly go far from seeing the center of open, but here's what I am above. I think apart from revelation, it's impossible.
Revelation without
rebel does not mean cynical when he said theologians speak to revelation.
Yeah, you've got to hang on to revelation, I believe, but revelation without reason turns out not to be real revelation. Revelation without reason is just the one form
tongues.
Of commission. Not speaking in tongues. It is. It's all right to speak in tongues if there's somebody there to interpret. Yeah, everything must edify the brotherhood. And that means it has to partake of rational structure. I say, God gave me this vision, and whoop, off I go. And I don't bother communicating with my brothers because God gave me a private vision. That we don't buy that because we ain't Schwärmers.
No,
when we say,
I think that there is one who is the word, and that's what his name is.
Yes, but the word, the logos, and there's the rational element. Jesus didn't come
but he remains his own interpreter, and the Spirit is given to interpret him.
But
and this is what gives all of us little ones a little gut to fight you who are the intellectual elite, that we, in our all simplicity, believe that there is the truth in Christ, the way in Christ, the life in him. And that he does reveal himself. If there is a self-authenticating aspect in revelation that involves reason, certainly, but then that apart from the Holy Spirit is not known. There is a wisdom given to those who are spiritual, as in the Holy Spirit.
I don't disagree with that, Carol.
And this is what I think reinforces society. This is Ricky's argument here, and that's why I wish Ricky were here, because he starts out with his Hans, whatever his name is, Venetian, and this whole relativism that our mountain climber over here was with, it produces Hitler, really. And this is the only kind of thing you get, a relativistic world finally will. Good old Bill finally ends up on the throne of the Nazi Party. I mean, when you have pure relativism, and somewhere, somebody has to produce indignation in society, so it's a valid, workable indignation.
But not private indignation.
No, I think that kind of revelational thing really tends to assume in the last analysis that the world isn't created by God, you know. You see, I mean, it makes a disjunction between God the Creator and God the Redeemer, which is what I always find very disturbing. You see, so there isn't any.
I would say in its present state you can't argue for it. You know, Lord of the Observed, no God. I'll say his argument here is right. in this present state, you can't earn them.
So, creation really has become annihilated. We only have a world created by demons left. You see, so we.
No, you have an ambivalence here. You have an ambivalence. But it is too ambivalent. The ambivalence is too big for us to be able to say that reason can sort out and choose. What it does is it creates a new elite, new intellectualism, a little group, a little cadre out of those who are the favored few and come and join the happy few, who are given this particular revelation by their unique reason.
But not, Carol, if these happy few believe that what they have seen and heard is communicable and that they must communicate it, then they cannot be a happy little elite. And this is what Christians assert. They assert the church and the witnessing task of the church.
Sure, but you've got to have something about man that allows God to be accessible to all men. And so certainly you've got to have a notion of man in his basic essence, which allows him within himself to discover God. Talk about phenomenologically. They really take an entirely different approach, which is logically antecedent and reasonable, in order to, escape from this problem.
But does man discover God, or does God discover man in his situation?
Yeah, well,
the story of Christ is God coming to man. And the story of religion is man trying to find God, trying to find that transcendence.
And I would say you could make exactly that same relationship in any religion.
No, I think
there's always an element. I mean, no religion says that they discover God. There's always God there first discovering them, and out of that they discover God. I mean, it's just two sides of the same coin in this effort to sort of say we have faith and they just have this self-discovery. It just falsifies and makes impossible any genuine ecumenism with other religions.
I wonder if we can't come to sacred ethics.
No, it's not sacredism at all. It's just decent respect and a little less damned egotism is what it is.
It doesn't involve, you see, there's a kind of an ecumenism that is worthless. It's the ecumenism that says, I have nothing to offer, neither do you, let's merge. There's an ecumenism that says, I have something that I want you to share, and I believe you have something that if I really get to know you and love you and discourse with you, that you can communicate to me. And that's the ecumenism that is of the Spirit.
Can I sort of get onto some other problem, which is what I wanted to ask on, and that is the thing that bothers me very much, and I see it running through an awful lot of sort of pastoral counseling situations. It is a way of using social science, particularly psychology, to create a sort of reductionist explanation for people's problems, and I sort of got into this myself with a girl who was having very complicated problems, and she was very emotional about it. I mean, she was extremely emotional about it. And so, I talked to her and all that stuff. And the problem that she was presenting was very much, an intellectual problem for her, and a problem of value and truth and so forth. You see, and then people who were working with her presented the problem that they thought perhaps this was just an attention-getting device. Well, this occurred to me that there was an emotional thing involved. You see, that this problem she had was also related to emotional needs. And I felt a very strong resistance to dealing with her in terms of this being an attention-getting device. I mean, because I felt that this, while it may be perfectly true, was really very secondary. You see, that I should deal with her in terms of the problem of which she was aware, namely problems of truth, problems of what really was the case, problems of what should I, this higher kind of problem, and I should not allow this problem that she was very obsessed with or disturbed with to be reduced to this sort of lower psychological explanation.
You refuse to objectify her.
Yeah.
You want to treat her as a genuine subject.
I wanted to deal with her problem as she saw it, which was a problem of truth and so on, and to talk about that problem and not talk about, well, is it really your mother has rejected you or something like that. I mean, it's true that this bigger problem may be serving as a vehicle for that other problem, but I think in the hierarchy of values, it's much more important to deal with her quest for truth and value. And as she resolves this, she may come to see this other thing too.
Can't we preserve here a polarity,
yeah,
recognizing that there are objective forces that determine us? We are caused. And our beliefs are caused, but they are also our beliefs. We, a subjective self, an inviolable self, order. We go out and impose a form upon that objective reality. And I think we've got to hang on to both of them. If we don't hang on to the objective part, then we throw away a lot of tools for aiding one another. If we don't hang on to the subjectivity, then we reduce all problems to a psychology. It's kind of a reductionism where someone says, oh, what a beautiful piece of music. And you translate that into, he was bopped over the head with a violin at the age of 2, and that's what he's really saying.
Assuming that there is a good that's identifiable, or can be some, not identifiable, that can be apprehended to some degree by man, how do you account for the wide contradiction of results of sensitive moral inquiry?
In part, that we are all the blind men of Hindustan who went out to view an elephant. Now that elephant was really there. And the elephant was, you know the poem, don't you? You know, because his question is if there isn't a reality about which ethical judgments are attempting to make statements, why is it that sensitive moral inquiry leads to different conclusions? And the first part of my answer is that we do only get a glimpse of it. And however sensitive we are, we don't cover the whole. And then, too, there are other factors. We get a glimpse, and we turn it into a system, and then we stop looking at the reality, and we begin considering what we can do to build up and shore up the system. Like we say, I've got an insight. It's a valid insight, an insight that came from real sensitive inquiry and consideration. And then as we begin building the system, we drag in all sorts of foreign elements to defend it and shore it up, and thereby impose blinders upon ourselves. I think this is essentially what happens. But I would add, it's been my experience that in the history of moral philosophy, from as far back as we have sources until now, there has not been really as much diametrical opposition as we are taught by the textbooks in history of philosophy. If we would stop studying the history of philosophy in one textbook and rather say take a system or two and really try to get into that, we would discover that really there isn't that kind of clash and opposition. These systems are more complementary.
But still, man is, you're saying that man is doomed to a road to hell, aren't you? I mean, no matter how earnestly the approach is made to confrontation, a relativism is the effect.
Now, what do you mean by relativism? We will never see the whole. We are, and I wouldn't say we're doomed to to run to. I think we must commit ourselves to tolerance, to means to relativism in practice, to the constant admission. This, no matter how strongly I feel about it, I may be wrong.